The Will Cain Show podcast is presented by the Capital One Saver Card. Earn 4% cash back on dining and entertainment, 2% at grocery stores, and 1% on all other purchases.
This is the Will Cain Podcast on ESPN Radio.
What did Kevin Durant expect? According to a new book, it's how the victory machine by Ethan Strauss, KD always felt the press. And the fans, by extension, were giving Steph the love that KD might deserve. What did Kevin Durant expect? It's the Will Cain Show on ESPN Radio, the ESPN app, SiriusXM Channel 80, and on ESPN News, presented by Progressive Insurance. And you can join the conversation at 888-729-3776. It's called The Victory Machine, The Making and Unmaking of the Warriors Dynasty. And the author is Ethan Strauss, a selection making the rounds today in sports media, referencing Kevin Durant's response to the media and how he felt he was treated in contrast to Steph Curry, is driving news. And Ethan Strauss of The Athletic is now on our phone lines. Ethan, thanks for jumping on today.
Thanks for having me, Will.
So let's get to KD in just a moment. I have to confess, the book just came out yesterday, right? I believe.
Yeah.
I haven't had a chance to read it yet.
I'm hanging up. Oh, I'm so mad.
You know what, though? You get a chance to sell me on it right here, along with all of our listeners.
Okay. No, an elevator pitch.
Let me focus on part that I don't know, but in your subhead certainly intrigues me. It's not just the unmaking, which I think most people are going to latch onto and part of this KD conversation revolves around, but the making of the Warriors dynasty. I'm kind of curious about when the Warriors knew they were on to something there. You know, obviously they had Steph and Clay, and they were under Mark Jackson. But, you know, when they realized this is something special, this is something different, even this is something revolutionary, there had to be a moment where they go, we're doing it different, and it's working here.
I think it all started to click in the preseason of 2014. I mean, they knew Steph was good. They knew Clay had some talent. But that preseason, you know, they say preseason basketball doesn't matter, throw it out, whatever. But if you look at their numbers, they were just performing amazingly on offense. If you watch them, I mean, it's one of the reasons why, I mean, I have a lot of predictions that don't work out, but I picked them to win the championship in 2014 is because I was one of the few people who watched every Warriors preseason game, and it was clear that suddenly the ball was moving, and it was like one of those stories you hear of David Halberstam, Portland Trailblazers, Bill Walton, where this is like watching people going from walking on their hands to suddenly walking on their feet. It was just different. Everybody saw it, everybody knew, and you saw the results immediately that season.
When they were building that team originally, Ethan, whatever clicked in 2014, the ball movement, the shooting, was the team built with that vision in mind, or was it a happy circumstance of ending up with these players who happened to click together?
I think that there was an aspect of happy circumstance because They like the idea of size. They wanted a bigger team. That's something that Joe Lacob, the owner, is into. It's something that Bob Myers is into. I don't know when they all took it over, they even had Steph Curry as part of their plans. I mean, they dangled him. They shopped him. They didn't think that he was going to be a star. And so there is this aspect with the Warriors where it's really hard to know where the luck ends and the vision begins, or right, reverse those two. I don't know, because if they had such a vision, if they knew how it would all work out, then they wouldn't have been trying to trade them. And in fact, as I say in the book, at one point they offered Steph and Clay for Chris Paul back in 2011. So imagine how that would have changed things. Right. So there's a lot of luck that lined up for circumstances to work out as it did.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting. So the making of a dynasty, what you've just offering Steph and Clay up for Chris Paul, it tells you it wasn't always a grand vision, right? It all wasn't always the reinvention of basketball. It was rather, as we said, a couple of happy circumstances in drafting, and then at some moment it clicking. I'm sure there was some vision, but
yeah.
To be clear,
you know, it mattered that Joe Lacob bought the team versus Chris Cohan, who was an absentee owner. When you have a terrible owner and there's a power vacuum, it just creates chaos. It's Game of Thrones. Everybody's knifing each other and undermining one another. Once you have some strength from the top and some pressure to win, that helps guide an organization. And then, you know, Joe Lacob, he's almost like a caricature. He's like Gavin Belson in Silicon Valley, or Daniel Plainview, where he just wants to win, but he's not really big on empathy, he's not really big on emotional intelligence. But he, oddly enough, could see it in other people, and he could hire people like Steve Kerr and Bob Myers and Rick Welts and very emotionally intelligent guys, and it seemed like they did a lot to foster a culture that subverted ego. And of course, having Steph Curry there, who is fairly egoless, even though we all have an ego, but among superstars, I think that helped build what became the Warriors.
Ethan Strauss of The Athletic and the author of a new book, The Victory Machine, The Making and Unmaking of the Warriors Dynasty, here on The Will Cain Show. Let's move somewhat to the unmaking. But that's not totally fair either, because of course there was a title won with KD. They were perhaps, I said it at the time, I think, one of the best teams, maybe the best team of all time in that one small window with Kevin Durant. But let's get to the part that's sort of making its rounds in the sports media. Your conversation with Kevin Durant, some of his angst about the way he felt like he was treated in contrast to Steph Curry.
Yeah, I think that became an issue later on. And there's been some reporting on it, too. I think Zach Lowe wrote about how in the aftermath of the first finals victory of the two that they had, I think, you know, Kevin Durant understandably might have wondered why the rules were different for him. Because if you remember, LeBron joins the Miami Heat, a super team. Everybody hates him. They're mad at him. Maybe not everybody, but a lot of people hate him. But then after losing against the Mavericks, they beat the Thunder, Kevin Durant's Thunder, in a finals where Kevin Durant is amazing offensively. And everybody hails LeBron. All is forgiven. He's the best player. He's the best player. Kevin Durant and the Warriors pummel the Cavs. KD wins finals MVP. LeBron can't guard him. You know, I talked to people within the Cavs organization at that time, and they said, yeah, Kevin Durant's the better player. LeBron can't guard him. And there was no grand reordering of who the best player was. Everybody shrugged. They said, okay, you know, you won the championship, but it was a 73-win team. LeBron's still the best player. And so it seemed as though it didn't do everything for him that he expected it to do. And I think it created a certain kind of angst that even Steve Nash talked about publicly, where there's this vision that when you finally win the championship, it's going to do everything that you wanted because you've been waiting your whole life to do it. And in the end, you're just still the same person. And in this case, you have the same reputation as before.
Oh, wow, that's fascinating. Because it makes you think, so KD joins Golden State, he deals with the slings and arrows, the criticism of you joined a dynasty, you joined our championship team, you joined the bandwagon, and he's probably telling himself right through that process, once we win it all, then I'll get the recognition. Not only that I don't feel like I've fully gotten Oklahoma City, but that I'm suffering through right now. And then when it's over, he doesn't get it, and that's what he feels so angsty about in the aftermath?
Yeah, yeah, and that's what gets you going, right? That's what gets you through it, probably. Such a long journey to win a championship is the idea that it's all going to be worth it. And I think he's not the only one. I think this is why NBA dynasties tend to come apart, because winning, in a sense, is a bit of a lie. You know, it doesn't completely change who you are. It doesn't take you from a person who is sad most of the time to somebody who is happy most of the time. Now, you know, you miss it when it's over. I think that these Bulls, these former Bulls, are going to be looking back and they're going to be thinking about some of the great times they had winning those championships and this upcoming documentary, and they'll miss it. And the Warriors will miss having been part of this finals run. But you see this happen again and again in the NBA. I mean, it's the Last Dance that we're talking about with the Bulls. They decided to break up effectively as an organization. I know Krause had a lot to do with it. Shaq and Kobe, they broke up. It wasn't worth it. Whatever they had together wasn't worth it to them. And you see not only this happen, but we're fascinated. When it comes to the NBA, and I think this is different from the NFL and baseball, we are really drawn from a literary perspective, not necessarily to the rise of the dynasty, but to the human elements that make it break up. Whether it's Breakthrough of the Game, David Halberstam and the Blazers, whether it's Shaq, Kobe, whether it's the Bulls, and I guess now the Warriors, it just seems to be something that's very NBA.
it's easier to see in the NBA. I think it's true of anything. It's true in business. It's true in football. It's what killed the Dallas Cowboys dynasty of the 90s, egos, right? Mm. But a lot of that is either hidden in the front office or it's hidden behind face masks. It's easy to see in the NBA. Plus, now it's played out on social media so we can see it so nakedly when it comes to personalities. Let me go back to KD for one moment. So KD leaves Golden State. I'm fascinated by the motivation now. He's not fulfilled with whatever he thought was going to come to fruition after winning in Golden State, and he goes to Brooklyn. In search of what this time, Ethan?
I mean, maybe comfort. It's funny. We still haven't gotten a lot of answers because he was injured, so there wasn't a lot of media availability from him. But he obviously had that friendship with Kyrie Irving. It seemed like they were a package deal wherever they were going, and he was already moving his business, 35 Ventures, to New York during that final season with the Warriors. So it was going to be one or the other. But it is a weird fit. I mean, I don't want to judge. If he found happiness there, if he found fulfillment, then great. But it's just strange. It's a team without much of a fan base. No offense if you're listening and you are a Nets fan. I think you know that to be the case. And they're kind of, you know, Clippers East, but maybe not as good. And it's a little bit like being off of the map of the public consciousness. So I hope it works out, but it is a very odd choice, yeah?
Yeah, I think it is. But I think Kevin Durant is a fascinating figure, and I know we delve so much into his psychology. I think his choice is going to have a lot to do with some emotional calculation that we're all trying to wrap our arms around. Ethan Strauss, the victory machine. Let me ask you one more question about the future, though, on the Warriors. You've followed this team closely, as close as anyone, for years. What's next for the Warriors? I mean, it's getting everybody back healthy. That's one thing. But the moves for Wiggins, they all seem like they're leading up to something, Ethan. They're leading up to a move and then perhaps another championship window. What is that next thing?
They've got a bit of a timeline problem because their guys are on the tail end of their primes. I mean, it happened quickly, but that's where they're at. I mean, we forget that Steph is now in his early 30s. And he's a smaller player than your average superstar. So they've got a bit of a timeline problem. They've got this upcoming high draft pick. They've got another draft pick the next season from the Wolves that, given their track record, could potentially be a very high draft pick, top three protected. And so I think the big question for them, because Joe Lacob loves the draft and loves potential, and he's just really into it. He watches all the different prospects, and he's so into the draft. Are they going to perhaps trade out and try to get everybody in the same timeline because the window is closing? Or are they going to try to replenish and make this thing sustainable in the way the San Antonio Spurs have been, where, yeah, maybe you're not going to be a 65-win juggernaut. You're going to be passable, but you're going to bring the young guys along into the culture. That's the big decision before them. I don't know what they're going to do. I am certain, though, that there are arguments on both sides happening within that organization.
All right, The Victory Machine, The Making and Unmaking of the Warriors Dynasty by Ethan Strauss. You can't go to a bookstore, most of you right now. Some of you can, perhaps, but you can go to Amazon. You can get it. Go check it out. All right, Ethan,
also,
really appreciate
your
time.
It's on Audible. I just want to say it's on Audible. I know everybody listening is like, oh, my God, it's the most beautiful voice I ever heard. I need to hear more of it. So
you read it yourself? Nice. Nice. Okay.
It was hard, man. What you do is hard.
And you do have a nice voice. I'm sure it's very good. All right, man. Thank you.
Thanks, Will.
There's Ethan Strauss. The Victory Machine. Go check it out. We ordered the offensive linemen, and how quickly would they go? A little bit earlier in the show, we have a draft pod up. I'm going to tell you all about it because you need to check it out. Also, I'll play you, when do the wide receivers go? Historic class, right? When do you need to get that receiver? It's coming up on the Will Cain Show.
Capital One knows life doesn't alert you about your credit card. That's why we created Eno, the Capital One assistant that looks out for surprise credit card charges like overtipping, duplicate charges, or potential fraud, then sends an alert to your phone and helps if you need to fix them. Another way Capital One is watching out for your money when you're not. Capital One, what's in your wallet? See CapitalOne.com for details.
Hello, this is your apartment. I need some favors from you. Your cat keeps rubbing against the kitchen island, and I can't return the favor. Can you give her extra pets for me? After that, could you bundle your renters and car insurance with Geico? We could save money, and it's easy to do online. And one last thing. Could you leave the TV on during the day? I need to catch up on my soaps.
Geico. For bundling made easy, go to geico.com today.
P.I. in Florida. What's up, P.I.?
Well, what's going on, man?
What's up?
First of all, yeah, you and Jay Bliss, that's a pretty good tag
as
team.
As defense attorneys?
Type thing. I want both of y'all on my team. But I'll take you in the South. You know, you got that little Texas twang that usually works pretty good in the courtrooms down here.
You'd feel good. P.I., if remember when you were on the phone with me and you got pulled over and we aired it live? If you'd gone to jail and, you know, you're sitting in the clink and it's me who walks through the door, you'd feel pretty relieved, right? Like, me as your defense attorney?
Yeah. He's pretty sharp. Texas New, looks like he might have had a New York education, though, but, yeah. Nice.
Now, by the way, if Stephen A. walks down the hall, how are you going to feel? Are you going to be like...
Stephen A. can go either way because he might blow a cap in the middle of the courtroom and everything may go south. He gets a little off his rocker sometimes. But he's good, you know, good arguments, but you just got to be worried because he might just slip out.
Hope this jury likes to be entertained. Otherwise, I'm going down.
Exactly. If they're like a bunch of straight shooters, you might be in some trouble.
What do you got, P.I.?
Dak. You know, my Dolphins. We couldn't give up three first-rounders for him. I think two will take your pick and probably give two second-rounders because we got to pay him. We got to pay him a lot, too. We can't pay him a little bit. We got to go ahead.
Three first is off the table. What deal are you offering me? Go ahead. Make me an offer.
I'm offering two first, two second for your first and Dak because we got to pay him.
Oh, why you get my first,
so,
too?
I want your first. Yeah, I want that.
That cancels out one of your first. So now you're offering me one first and 2 seconds for Dak.
Yep.
No.
Because we got to pay him $40
million. Starting,
what's the point?
Starting bid begins at 2 firsts, and that's not going to get it done. If you don't come to me with more than 2 firsts, I'm not doing my side of the deal.
I'm coming 2 firsts, 2 second. I want your first because we got to pay him. I could just go get Cam Newton, have almost the same quarterback, and hope for the best as far as the health thing. This is like a Dante Culpepper, Drew Brees type thing. Because we got to pay him 40. That's the big deal. The big difference is the $40 million. If it wasn't for the 40, if he already had a contract put together that was pretty decent, you know, we can talk about 3 firsts, but that's a lot of money, man.
Hey, two
it's
things.
A whole lot of
I
money.
Don't think it's going to take $40 million to get that done. I truly don't. I don't know what the holdup is. I don't know if it's guarantees. I think it's years from what we hear. Most of it's about the number of years involved in the contract.
Probably Stephen Jones trying to raid his party. He didn't get
invited. By the way, I haven't updated that story today. Dak is very upset. The word I would use is defiant. He's pretty, a little apologetic, but mostly defiant because he's saying, I didn't have more than 10 people and everybody's going bananas on this deal right now on the party.
Yeah, and my owner guy is the one who's pretty much snitched on him. He's acting like he's my dad. I don't want to hear that.
I'd be more mad at one of his buddies, somebody at that party.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Sneak somebody took a picture and put it out.
But point is, I don't think Dak's going to require $40 million. And on top of that, let's say it's $36, $37 million. I just don't think that's going to kill your team. It's not. I don't think the salary cap can be managed. It can be manipulated. It's not about the number. It's giving the number to the wrong guy. And I don't think Dak's the wrong guy.
Okay, so this is what I'm saying. So you think Dak is worth 35, 3 first-rounders, maybe a second, over you can keep all of your picks, pay a Cam like 22, and then still draft a Tua or Justin Herbert or Love Dude, any one of those guys, and you still got 12 more picks. So you tell me which one sounds like a better deal.
So I wouldn't require three, probably. I'd probably say I need 2 firsts. I'll go ahead and take your 2 seconds. I'll take that. I'll keep all my draft picks. You get Dak. If you don't like that, you can keep your first, which are about a 50-50 proposition that you're going to end up with even a starting quarterback in the NFL, and go with God with Cam if that's what you want to do. Otherwise, that's the deal. And I got to go home and think about it. 2 firsts and 2 seconds for Dak? I'm not even sure I'm in on that.
Yeah, I hear you, but the biggest thing with Dak is they went 8-8 last year. Dolphins aren't better than the Cowboys roster-wise. Like, I'm paying a whole lot of boat for 8-8, dude. That's come on, man. We don't have a better team than the Cowboys as of right now. We're building something, but it's definitely not, you know, talent-wise, it's good. So what's going to be the difference? We're going to end up 8-8 with all those draft picks gone. We just built up all this equity, going 5-11.
The good news is this isn't happening. It's all ridiculous. You can
none of this stuff's happening
at
all.
You can hope for Tua. You're
right.
You can hope for – you want Tua or you want
I want Tua. I definitely want Tua.
Definitely.
I'm not worried about the injury.
Me too. That's what I want for you, Tua. All right, P.I., take care, man.
All right, man, you too. Be safe.
Dolphins definitely need to take Tua. Let's order these wide receivers, plus there's increasing optimism that sports is going to be back in June, but what will it look like? We're starting to get some notice, and it includes no fans. That's coming up on The Will Cain Show.
GEICO gets you access to licensed agents 24/7, which means that GEICO is always there for you. If only everyone was always there for you. Like your mom, when you fill out really, really important paperwork on the first day of a new job.
Name, check. Birthday, social security, is that a thing? Hey, mom, what is my social security number? Mom? Okay, let's guess. 0017. Oh, Gemini. Hashtag done.
GEICO, always there for you with savings and 24/7 access to licensed agents.
It's beginning to look like we're going to have sports back, possibly soon, possibly as early as May and June. But what will that look like? Probably no fans. I'll get to that in just a moment here on The Will Cain Show. But I did a draft podcast with Matt Miller of Bleacher Report and Lance Zierlein of NFL.com, two guys who I really respect their work. Look, I love the NFL draft. I love it. I love these guys' work. So I love the opportunity to sit down and talk with them for well over an hour. And not just about the first round. Look, I love the draft like this. I go to FanSpeak, which was a site I like a lot, which will run draft simulations, and I can play GM with my team. I'm not getting paid for this, by the way. I just do this. When I'm bored, sometimes I'm like, yeah, I'm just going to run a simulation on a mock draft. Do you guys do that real quick? Mike A., Bubba Nuno, you guys all like the draft. You ever do that for your teams?
I did it once, and I got angry at the other people in the draft who were doing things that's like, that would never happen, so I don't want to do it.
You got to pick the right big board. They have like 20 big boards you can pick from, and you're right. Some of them, I'm like, Tua drops to 20. I'm like, I'm out on this draft. That's not realistic. But most of them are pretty good, and it will simulation off. Like Matt Miller has a big board up on that site you can use, and it will sim out a draft. You hear that? You like that lingo? Sim out. It'll simulate a draft, and you can go five rounds and see, okay, if you get a offensive lineman in the first round, this is the wide receiver I get in the second round. It's really fun. Anyway, I love the second and third round as much as I do the first, so I got to talk to these guys. You should go check out the podcast. It's in the Will Cain Show feed. You can listen to a good deep dive. I'm talking third round stuff on receivers, safeties, the whole thing. We talked about receiver, which is supposed to be one of the deepest parts of this draft class. Here's what the guys had to say. To me, every one of those teams we're talking about have a young quarterback. It's a no-brainer to me. If these guys are good, and that's where I defer to you guys, if these offensive tackles are good, I would rather have an offensive lineman over wide receiver every day of the week for my young quarterback.
And especially, like, this has been called a historic wide receiver class, and it is really, really deep. No, there's no doubting that. You have to go tackle in round one, a receiver in round two. And, like, the Jets at 11, they don't just need a tackle and a receiver. They need an edge. They need a right tackle. They need a corner. And so, you know, a lot of these teams, you know, even the Browns, like Lance said, they need a receiver. They need a safety. They can take a linebacker. So it's just a matter of, we've been told over and over again, anyone who follows football, that offensive tackle is premium. It's quarterback. And then you can decide if it's edge rusher or offensive tackle. But those are the three most important positions. And that's what I agree. I think we're going to see the tackles go before the receivers because of the importance of the position and the depth. You mentioned it, Lance. You don't feel great about Josh Jones and Austin Jackson and Isaiah Wilson and Ezra Cleveland. You feel pretty good about the receivers you could have in round two.
Matt, I saw you writing as well. Let's talk about the receivers. You like CeeDee Lamb, but you don't think he's a wide receiver one.
Well, I worry. I think so much of it, like, it comes in a scheme fit. And I'm not trying to, like, find a cop-out, and I don't want to hedge on it. My concerns with CeeDee Lamb is a lot of contested catches on his tape, which oftentimes points to a guy who can't separate. And Oklahoma's offense did a great job of giving him free releases. Like, this dude, I know you can find a clip of him beating press coverage, but it's not something that he did very often. The Big 12's not exactly known as a great cornerback conference. So I think with Lamb, like, I'm a little bit worried about how much of the production came from the scheme. And then when he was challenged, how often he had to make contested catches. You know, with receivers, if you're a great route runner, you're going to get open. Michael Thomas ran a 4.56. He's probably the best receiver in the game because he's a great route runner when it comes to timing and physicality. Lamb could be that, but I do worry a little bit about that transition if he, for the first time in his life, he has to be press coverage for a whole game.
Everybody says Judy's a great route runner, and I believe that 100%, but with his seemingly poor testing with athleticism, and then I combine that with the incredible bust rate among wide receivers. I was looking at it since 2015, how many wide receiver ones have come out of the first round? And the answer is probably one, Amari Cooper. We'll see if somebody else like Marquise Brown turns into that or whoever. But it just, I sit here and I go, how good is Judy, guys?
No, I do think he is a really good route runner. I mean, he's sharp with his routes. You know what's interesting is when you go back and look at Alabama, I've noticed this for a while. The testing, like the explosive testing, the broad jump, the vertical leap, if you look at Calvin Ridley's explosive testing, it wasn't that great either.
Right.
And which I was really surprised at that. And you can look at quite a few Alabama guys and get that, which, you know, always was a little puzzling to me. But I think Jerry Jeudy has a lot of similarities to Calvin Ridley in that he's got good speed. I think he's got good play speed. When the game is going, when he's in the middle of a game, I think he plays pretty fast. And he's really comfortable with hiding and disguising his route breaks. In other words, you don't see him getting in and out of his breaks, but he can, when he does it, he's not going to give it away. There's no tells at the poker table, but he can snap it off very quickly. He can make his routes very, very sharp. And so he's going to create that separation. CeeDee Lamb is not a great route runner. So CeeDee Lamb does have some issues with separation that I'm concerned about. But Jerry Jeudy, I'm not sure that he can play outside. I'm not sure he is a true outside receiver. So with Jerry Jeudy, I think you have a specialized slot who can get you a lot of catches because he is going to get open. But I don't know that he is ever going to be a guy who takes over games and makes as many explosive plays as you saw on the collegiate level. I think he can. I mean, I think he does have that kind of speed when he's matched against certain types of slots. But I still see him more as a wide receiver too, who can really up his value if he gets with the right offense that understands how to utilize what he does well from the slot.
Wide receiver.
Hey, that's
two.
What I was going to say.
Wow.
I think scheme matters so much with this receiver class specifically because, you know, there's not a guy who has it all in terms of size, speed, where, you know, there's not a Julio Jones. There's not an A.J. Green. There's not a Calvin Johnson. These are small guys. 6'1", 193 for Jeudy. 6'1", 198 for Lamb. You know, these aren't big players. To your point about the combine, Will, I've had a hard time with combine numbers this year. I almost feel like you just have to throw them out in some cases because – and maybe I'm just too much of an optimist. It feels like this entire combine, the numbers were bad for everyone. So I don't know how reliable they are with the schedule change and the, you know, the uncertainty about workouts.
Listen to Matt Miller of Bleacher Report and Lance Zierlein of NFL.com. Wait till rounds 2, 3, and 4. They'll still be good receivers. And these guys at the top may not be the wide receiver ones you're hoping for. You can go check out the whole podcast in the Will Cain Show podcast feed. All right, coming up. The prospect of sports returning in June seems real, but without fans. It's going to require a lot of testing. It's going to require quarantines at some point for some of the big sports, and the NFL may be getting ready for it. That's coming up on the Will Cain Show on ESPN Radio and the ESPN app.
Foot odor throwing you off your game? Stick to a winning game plan with Odor Eaters, featuring 3 advanced odor and wetness fighters. The lineup provides long-lasting odor control plus more to keep your feet on their game.
Odor Eaters powder provides outstanding moisture control. Clear drying spray is the MVP in preventing athlete's foot, while insoles work continuously to manage wetness while adding a layer of comfort. Pick up today at Walmart, Target, CVS, Dollar General, or other fine retailers.
Odor Eaters. Destroy foot odor with the best in odor defense.
This Day in Baseball History with Tim Kirkjian.
This date in 1947, Jackie Robinson became the first African-American to play in the major leagues. He was a great player. He was a Hall of Fame player, and he was the most important player in the history of the game. When he made his debut with the Dodgers, he changed baseball, and he helped change our country. It was difficult. It was dangerous. He faced hate every day. He got death threats, and yet he played his way through it. Rex Barney, former Dodger pitcher, once told me, "Jackie Robinson is the strongest person I have ever seen." Frank Robinson, who came shortly after Jackie Robinson, told me, "Jackie taught us so many lessons, and one of those lessons was, if you want to beat them, if you want to beat the hate, you beat them on the field."
That's a good This Day in Baseball History. It's the Will Cain Show on ESPN Radio, presented by Progressive Insurance. Progressive's Home Quote Explorer is changing the way you buy home insurance. Now you can go online, get a custom quote and save both time and money. Learn more at progressive.com. Nuno, you were too busy writing your insult to me just now. You didn't finish off the read. Did you notice that?
A bad copy and paste by me?
Yeah, you didn't.
I didn't notice that.
You were too busy insulting me, typing out insults to me.
Hold on. Here's the deal, though.
No, do you want to read everybody what you're typing? Huh?
Well, part of the reason is I don't see the rest of it on my the email that someone sends me with the billboards. Mm-hmm. So I have to double check that.
It wasn't that you were distracted.
I have it here, so I don't know.
So I don't know what happened here. Oh, yeah. Do you want me to tell people what I was joking about?
Yeah, that you said because I hadn't brought up a Jackie Robinson anniversary that once again proves Will is a racist. That's what you said.
I didn't say it, but might have put it on the screen.
What's the difference?
Verbally versus written. You know I don't communicate well verbally.
I don't know that you communicate that well written either.
That is very true sometimes.
Dr. Anthony Fauci went on Snapchat's Good Luck America, and he started to give a vision of when sports could return. And he talked about it being as soon as June. Listen to this.
There's a way of doing that. Nobody comes to the stadium. Put them in big hotels, you know, wherever you want to play. Keep them very well surveilled, namely a surveillance, but have them tested like every week and make sure they don't wind up infecting each other or their family and just let them play the season out. I mean, people say, well, you know, you can't play without spectators. Well, I think you probably get enough buy-in from people who are dying to see a baseball game, particularly me. I'm living in Washington. We have the world champion Washington Nationals. You know, I want to see them play again.
So, if you can get past the music there, come back in June, play in empty stadiums, quarantine the players, and test them. This is similar to what the Bundesliga, a German soccer league, is discussing, bringing back their league as early as potentially May. In a report in the New York Times, it showed the financial implications of not coming back. That if this German soccer league, the Bundesliga, doesn't come back, as much as 50% of the second division teams could go bankrupt. So to come back, they need to test they need 240 tests per game. That's players, coaches, and support staff. And you gotta be tested every game. But the tests are imperfect. There's a ton of false negatives. You could have it, you test negative. In that case, when you eventually do test positive, they can't backtrack when you would have tested positive, so they can't then do a chain, you know, of who have you been exposed to, who have you exposed, and you can't then figure out how many people need to be quarantined. This has been the problem in South Korea and China as they've tried to bring back leagues. Now, Major League Baseball has explored the possibility of antibody testing, testing all their players to see if anybody's already had it and built up immunity. There's some sense out there. We don't know anything. That's the big point. We don't know anything, but there's some sense that more people have had coronavirus than we actually know. They've been asymptomatic, had it, and recovered, and never knew the whole time. In fact, they say 30 to 50% of people that could have had this have been asymptomatic altogether. And if you can antibody test players, perhaps then you can create a league. But here's the thing. All this quarantining, think how high a bar that is. Carl Anthony Towns' mom died. So you're going to say you can't interact with anybody in your family. So you're talking about 19, 20-year-old NBA players who can't be around their parents. You're talking about 32-year-old players who can't be around their kids for months at a time. I do think we're going to get sports back, but the logistics of this aren't going to be so easy. Not easy at all. Even if we agree, and it looks like most certainly we will, that we'll do it without fans in the stands. Ryan Day, Ohio State's football head coach, was on a teleconference, and he talked about how it could be safe for the players.
My thought process in all this is that we need to look at all options. If the ideal situation arises, great, but if not, well, what are we going to do to try to come up with some sort of football, keeping everybody safe and healthy? You know, I think the biggest challenge with that is going to be, if it's not safe for the fans, then how is it safe for the players and for the coaches and those types of people?
It's going to be through massive testing and quarantining. And then we have to ask ourselves if that's logistically possible. What more, then you deal with the whole thing we've been talking about on the show for weeks. How do you deal with state-to-state, region-to-region differences? Lindsay Theory, ESPN's Rams Nation reporter, tweeted this out. The LA Times is reporting that Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti told high-level staff from several departments that big gatherings, such as sports and concerts, might not be approved until 2021. Would that include the players, or just how about the fans? How about the audience? Could you get the players on the field? Can we do it logistically? Can we test them? Can we quarantine them? I do think we're about to have sports back in some form, but we're a long way from answering exactly what that form will be.
Thank you for listening to the Will Cain Podcast. You can listen to the Will Cain Show live weekdays at 3 Eastern on ESPN Radio and on the ESPN app. The Will Cain Podcast.